This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. I use it with my patients at the Hoffman Center all the time. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, the company is offering you special savings of $50 and free shipping. To find out more, go to TryZonaNow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman to get your $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or TryZonaNow.com.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine, America's foremost program on health, medicine, and nutrition, featuring the latest on both conventional and alternative therapies. Now, here's Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We have lots to talk about this weekend, and we invite you to call us. 888-302-3684 gets you directly into the doctor's office, where you can pose a question about medicine, nutrition, any aspect of health. 888-302-3684, we want you to participate. But we've got lots to talk about because it's been a busy week on the health front. And, you know, that's what I do each week. I cull the medical journals and the media looking for articles of relevance to your health. And, you know, we try to interpret some of this stuff for you because a lot of the headlines are dumbed down and don't really reveal the truth about some important health facts. So here we go. 888-302-3684, while you're dialing, this study looks at, well, the theme here is over-testing. You know, we routinely go to the doctors, and if we're healthy, the doctor does what are called screening tests on us. And actually, it's really come into question whether the annual physical exam is valid from a scientific standpoint. I mean, it makes sense to go to the doctor to get checked out, but when it comes down to the proof of effectiveness in terms of detecting disease or extending our longevity, there's some concern that tests are expensive and sometimes can create undue worry, the need for additional tests to confirm the fact that what they thought was wrong in the first place isn't really wrong, and so on. So still, we test people routinely. We tell women to get an annual pap smear. And you reach a certain age and you wonder, is it really necessary for me to go to the gynecologist and get my annual pap smear? Well, here's a study that looks at that particular issue. It's from the British Medical Journal. And it suggests that women over the age of 40 could safely have pap smears just, get this, once a decade. All right? And there are some caveats here, but this is an important study because, well, we just do these things. Why do we do it? Well, it's kind of like, you know, the musical Fiddler on the Roof. Tradition, tradition, tradition. You keep doing the same things that you did in the past, and you don't question them. Well, get your annual pap smear. That's one of the verities of medicine. This study published this week in the British Medical Journal suggests that once you reach 40, you could have less frequent screening. It's based on a study of more than 43,000 Dutch women. And here's the caveat. If you have already had the test several times, and if it is normal, and importantly, if you were found to be free of the HPV virus, which is linked to cervical cancer, you can slash the frequency to once every 10 years. It just won't matter at all. It doesn't make a difference in terms of the potential for preventing cervical cancer. Now, currently, it's very frequent that women in that age group continue to get annual pap smears. Every year, they're normal, and you keep going for annual pap smears. Well, maybe, just maybe, those pap smears could detect something else. But studies even suggest that ovarian cancer, which is hard to detect with a blood test, that annual internal exams make little difference in terms of detecting ovarian cancer early. Usually, ovarian cancer is detected based on a woman reporting symptoms. She may have pain or bloating or lower abdominal swelling. And that is, you know, certainly a reason to go get checked out. But routine pelvic ultrasounds, routine CA-125 tests, even routine internal exams may not help us turn the tide against that dread disease. So why is it that HPV is the decider in this test? Well, it turns out that women who carry the HPV virus are at much higher risk of having cervical cancer. And if you don't have it, it turns out you're at very low risk. So here's what they do. These days, they do a pap smear. The original pap smear just looks at the shape and size of cells and then rates you on a scale. If it's normal, that's okay. If it's abnormal, all right, you need further investigation. But what they do now is they also test you for HPV. And it turns out that that causes 95% of cases of cervical cancer. And if you're negative, well, then maybe, just maybe, you don't need that many pap smears. And hey, who wants a pap smear? You know, I've never had one, but from what women report, it's not the most pleasant thing in the world, jumping up on that table and getting into stirrups. Even the name stirrups, you know, that has some unpleasant connotations in a field once dominated by men. Now, where lots of female gynecologists are a little more compassionate and empathetic, have made inroads. Now, the screening could be implemented less frequently in women who are at low risk. And I hope, you know, I just hope that studies like this persuade doctors to urge their patients to forego examinations. Yeah, yeah. What a concept. Maybe, just maybe, you need less visits to the doctor's office. And here's another one. This is a colonoscopy. They say here, no randomized controlled trials of screening colonoscopy have been completed. And ongoing trials exclude persons aged 75 years or older. So here's something we're doing, but there's no randomized controlled trials of screening colonoscopy. Well, you know, it's kind of, you know, how do you do a randomized controlled trial, double-blind placebo, where the doctor doesn't know whether it's a real colonoscopy and the patient doesn't know it's a real colonoscopy? Hey, you pretty much know you're either giving or getting a colonoscopy. So pretty hard to do randomized controlled trials. Ongoing trials exclude persons aged 75 years or older. So they ask the question, what about people who are older? Should they get colonoscopies anymore at all? Right? Well, you know, there's a certain point at which, you know, maybe, just maybe, you stop getting colonoscopies. Well, they did the study. And by the way, this does not mean that if you have severe gastrointestinal problems, if you have pain, or if you have blood in your stool, or if you have a sudden change in bowel habits, that's the medical term that's used. You go from normal bowel movements to all of a sudden you're extremely constipated. Well, maybe, just maybe, yeah, you need a colonoscopy, because that could be an early sign of colon cancer. But what about routine screening colonoscopy in the older population? And by the way, not without risk. What they found is that the risks of adverse events were about 6 events per 1,000 individuals. Well, that's not that many, but for those 6 individuals, pretty bad. Maybe a puncture of their intestinal wall, maybe some kind of bleeding episode. Who knows? Because you put an instrument up there and, you know, sometimes, or even the potential for infection. That's happened too. What they found is that there was very, very little risk, almost statistically undetectable, among those aged 75 to 79 in terms of a benefit of, finding or treating colorectal cancer. And, there was not any information that cancer deaths were averted with this test in the older population. So maybe, just maybe, you know, dutifully showing up for your routine colonoscopy after you've had several normal ones past a certain age just doesn't make sense. And with newer techniques whereby you can offer a stool sample that is very sensitive for cancer-specific DNA, the so-called Cologuard test that is now being offered, this may preclude the need for this uncomfortable, expensive, and sometimes hazardous test. as a screening test in an older population, or maybe just maybe are a little more vulnerable to the potential side effects or consequences of testing. 888-302-3684 is our number. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'd love to hear from you. This is Intelligent Medicine.
Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor here, president of the Texas Organic Research Center. As you probably know, it's a toxic world out there, but we can do something about it. Become knowledgeable consumers and use products that are safe and healthy, such as natural supplements that help protect the body's cells from toxic exposure. One of my favorites is Reg Active with ME3, the only probiotic proven to actually produce glutathione in the body. It's the body's master antioxidant, unique in its ability to repair and rebuild cellular damage caused by free radicals and exposure to environmental toxins. Glutathione decreases as we age. Reg Active is great for rebuilding it, and I strongly recommend it.
Look for Reg Active at Whole Foods, Sprouts, and other fine health food stores nationwide where Dr. O'Hara's probiotics are sold. Revolutionary. Remarkable. Reg Active. Congratulations! You've survived disco nights and 12-hour days, not to mention fast food and life in the fast lane. Now it's time to fight the effects of modern life in the digital age and aging itself with one of life's natural miracles, garlic. Its healing and health-giving properties are great, but what about the odor? Well, you don't need to eat raw cloves to get all the good things in garlic. Just take Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract. University research confirms that Kyolic is the one true antioxidant garlic supplement. It helps defend you against free radicals and helps keep blood pressure and cholesterol in check. So if Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract can do everything researchers report, just think what it could do for you. See for yourself. For more information, go to Kyolic.com. That's Kyolic.com. Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract. For people who take their garlic and their health seriously, look for Kyolic where quality natural supplements are sold.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. 888-302-3684. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us with questions. 888-302-3684. And before we get to your calls or some of the stuff we're going to talk about today, I'd like to share with you something that we've been getting great feedback on. Lots of people are trying it and liking it. Blood pressure, big problem, because diet and exercise sometimes aren't enough. And then you got to go on medication. And then people are crying bloody murder about all the side effects of the medication. It slows them down. It makes them feel lightheaded and woozy. They lose their sex drive. So we're always angling for something that is natural to help us with our blood pressures. Well, there is an option, and I think it's a really, really good one. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure 10% or more naturally. It's the Zona Plus, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. Now, what is it? It's a simple handheld smart device, a little ritual that you perform for 12 minutes once a day, and you do it for 4 to 8 weeks. And at least 22 clinical studies confirm that regular use can result in an average decrease in blood pressure of 10% or more. And, of course, there are no side effects with this. So you can try it risk-free as part of special offer to Intelligent Medicine listeners. Zona Health offers a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Try the Zona Plus for 3 months and see if it works for you. And if it doesn't, you can return it for a full refund. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, the company is also offering you special savings of $50 and free shipping. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman to get your $50 savings and free shipping. That's 866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Give it a shot. I think it'll really work for you. Okay, this one has to do with things that you should or shouldn't do before breakfast. All right, we'll keep you in suspense while we talk to David in Airmont, New York. How you doing, David?
I'm I'm just shutting the. I'm trying to shut the. The sound on my computer. Sorry. I'm on Coumadin after I had my left hip replaced.
Yeah.
And, you know, the doctors, basically the surgeons and stuff, have told me not to take any vitamins. Usually I take 30 vitamins and anti-inflammatory stuff. And I thought I would just check with you on certain things that
I could take
a multivitamin, vitamin C, my fish oil, and that's about it.
Okay, so that's because of, out of sheer ignorance that they say that. And look, they just don't know what the heck is out there, and it's all bewildering to them. So they say, well, you know. Who knows what kind of stuff this guy's going to be taking? So let's just tell him to take a Centrum or, you know, one a day multivitamin. Those are pretty innocuous. There's not much in them anyway. You know, and leave it be, right? Because it's otherwise it gets too complicated. So there are supplements that you should avoid when you take Coumadin, but you have to be a little knowledgeable to discern which ones are okay to take with Coumadin and which ones aren't. The main one that you shouldn't take at high doses is vitamin K, because vitamin K antagonizes Coumadin. But there are some studies that suggest that even, you know, small amounts of vitamin K will not have a big impact on the Coumadin. And besides, vitamin K is healthy for the arteries, which, by the way, is a big problem for usually older people who are on Coumadin. You know, you want to protect your arteries and you want to protect your bones. That's what vitamin K does. But in an abundance of caution, I would suggest that you avoid taking specific vitamin K supplements. The small amounts of vitamin K that may be in a multi aren't going to make a difference. And then there's some people who say, well, stay off fish oil because fish oil is a blood thinner and you don't want two blood thinners on board. That could be dangerous. But actually, studies show that fish oil reduces the risk of pathological bleeding while you're on Coumadin. Doesn't make sense because it is a bit of a blood thinner, but somehow it seems to regularize the functioning of the platelets in such a way that you actually have less pathological bleeding. You get the same good blood thinning effects from the Coumadin to prevent blood clots from forming, but you have less adverse bleeding events. So then there's other people who say CoQ10 could be implicated. Not really. Vitamin E in high dose is a bit of a blood thinner, but usually doesn't pose a problem when people are taking Coumadin. So, you know, I would have to review all the supplements you're taking, but, you know, I think you could take most of your supplements, except for vitamin K, with Coumadin. And this is just an example of how doctors sometimes they throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to supplements. Like before surgery, they'll say, don't take any supplements before surgery. Well, we know that supplements actually help surgical recovery. And yes, there are some supplements that increase bleeding, but we have to be discerning about which ones we include and which ones we exclude. So there's the story for you, David. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening on your computer. You are fully integrated with the cyber age. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about some things to do before sport and some things to avoid before sport. This is Intelligent Medicine.
Why do I use the Spry Dental Defense System? Because it tastes great.
Because fillings are ugly.
There are a lot of reasons to use the Spry Dental Defense System, a complete line of oral care products such as toothpaste, mouthwash, gum, mints, and more, made with 100% xylitol. But the best reason is because it works. And because it's all natural, Spry is 100% safe for kids. There are even Spry products developed especially for your children and toddlers.
Because my dental hygienist told me to.
Because it's all natural.
So ask for Spry by name whenever you buy toothpaste, mouthwash, gum, mints, or anything else for your mouth. And make sure you're receiving all the benefits of 100% xylitol products.
Because I want a great smile, duh. Why do I use Spry? Because it works?
The Spry Dental Defense System. Great taste, less fillings. For information or to purchase Spry, visit SpryDental.com.
Available at Whole Foods, Vitamin Shoppe, and other fine natural products retailers.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. And let's talk about some things to do before exercise and some things not to do before exercise. There's an interesting statistic here about the Rio Olympics. 450,000 condoms were distributed around the athlete's village. And, okay, you had maybe several thousand young athletes there, but 450,000. And then there's this whole urban legend, maybe an old wives' tale, that sex before sport can negatively impact your athletic performance. And so it was that researchers studied this phenomenon. Dr. Lori Stefani, who's an assistant professor of sports medicine at the University of Florence, Italy, did a review of the scientific evidence that either supports the contention that pre-exercise sex diminishes performance or makes no difference at all in athletic performance. They looked at hundreds of studies, big and small, on the impact of sexual activity upon sport performance. And here's what they found. They found that it made no difference whatsoever in terms of athletic performance. Now, there's this common view that abstinence from sexual activity can boost athletic performance. It somehow increases aggressiveness. This is something that is pretty common in boxing culture. You know, don't have sex before, you know, you have a fight because you become sort of relaxed and gentle and lose your aggressive edge. But one study that they reviewed here at the University of Florence is showed that there was actually a beneficial effect on marathon runners' performance. But that was just one among many studies. Most of the studies showed no difference. One of the studies found that the strength of female athletes did not differ if they had sex the night before. So although they studied men more frequently than women, there did not appear to be a difference. So, you know, we kind of give the green light to sexual activity as long as it's not exhausting. You know, maybe, you know, doing it while hanging from a chandelier or some very athletic form of sexual expression. Yeah, that might exhaust you, but normal sex, no big impact. Okay, so here's another thing that could impact athletic performance. But this is actually something that I do personally, is when I exercise, the vast majority of times I exercise in the morning. And I've gotten in the habit of getting up and having a cup of black decaf, maybe. If I'm going to go a really long distance, have a big workout, maybe I'll just have a little bit of fruit, maybe a half a grapefruit, but, or, you know, maybe a small handful of strawberries. But I usually exercise fasting, and it may be 10 o'clock before I eat. And that's worked well for me, and I've gotten used to it. Now, of course, if I'm going to take, you know, a 60-mile bike ride or something, I'm going to eat something. Because you just run out of fuel. But for an hour's bout of exercise, you rarely need to eat if you're trained to it. So researchers at Northumbria University in England found, well, they did an experiment where they had 12 physically active male participants who were well-conditioned. Because you have to be fairly well-conditioned to do this. I think people who are deconditioned, they need to take something before they exercise. They just don't store glycogen very well in their muscles, and they need fuel, like a car needs fuel before you take a long drive. But for people, we fairly efficiently can store energy, and you can access your fat stores as fuel. That's called fat adaptation. And so they looked at 12 physically active male participants, and they either had them have exercise before a 10 a.m. meal, or they had a snack before the exercise. So what they found was important for people who were trying to use exercise as a means of losing weight. Those who exercised in a fasted state burned almost 20% more fat compared to those who had consumed breakfast before their workout. It makes sense, because if you have breakfast, you've got calories in your bloodstream that can provide you with fuel. So you use those and you won't burn down your fat stores. If you have fasted, you're going to actually reach into your fat stores for fuel for energy. They found no decrease in performance due to the fasting state. The eating didn't help. And in fact, some studies suggest that eating slows you down. And you might also say, well, what about, were they hungrier because they'd fasted? It turns out that exercise did not increase their appetite. It did not increase hunger or food consumption later in the day. And their recommendation is to get the most out of your morning exercise. It may be optimal to perform the morning workout after an overnight fast. So trying to get, really chiseled in terms of your lean-to-fat ratio, make sure that you exercise in a fasted state and then go eat. 888-302-3684 is our number. What about those brain games? A lot of people are trying to use brain games to sharpen their minds, to fend off dementia. As we live longer, more and more baby boomers and seniors are worried that they're losing it. So that has given rise to companies like Lumosity, which offers brain games, which it was claimed could keep you intellectually sharp. Well, Lumosity recently settled with the Federal Trade Commission because of exaggerated claims about the ability of these games to prevent cognitive decline, because the science just isn't there. They were going a bridge too far in terms of claiming the efficacy of these games to slow cognitive decline. And here's yet another nail in the coffin of the assertion that brain training games yield real-world benefits. They did a systematic review of scientific studies that are cited by brain training companies as evidence that their products improve cognition in daily life. This was performed at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And what they found was no convincing evidence to support those claims. Now, people tend to improve on the specific tasks they practice. I mean, you're going to see some improvement. You're going to go into it and you're going to say, wow, this is hard. And by the end of your training sessions, you're going to achieve proficiency, which leads you to believe that you're smarter. But that's just a training effect because you just get used to the format of the test. Anybody can learn to take a test, do better with practice. But does that have global effects on your overall IQ or mental performance or memory? And the answer is no. There is no what is called transfer of training to other realms of intelligence. Yes, you get better at the game or the, just like, I mean, you could start learning piano or guitar or bridge at the age of 70. And that's good, but does it carry over to other aspects of your life? And the answer is, probably, it's just a good thing to do. It keeps you active. It keeps you social, which is probably important. But there were 132 journal articles cited by a large group of brain training proponents in support of their claims. And what they found was that in analyzing these, they were poor studies. There were glaring problems in the cited research, inadequate control groups. Some of the studies had no control group. Some of the studies tested improvement on abstract laboratory tasks rather than on measures of real-world performance. So, unfortunately, this whole industry, and it is a huge multi-million-dollar industry, is kind of going south in terms of its scientific credibility because of research like this that shows no real tangible benefits to these brain games. What is helpful and demonstrably helpful, exercise, as dumb as it may seem. It doesn't take a genius to swim in a pool, to do laps around a track, or lift weights, right? What's the mental challenge of doing that? But it turns out that doing so demonstrably increases brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is something that helps to revive neurons in the brain, improves circulation, and reduces inflammation. Ultimately, these are, and reduces insulin resistance. These are factors that are real world factors that can cause progressive cognitive decline. So exercise your body, exercise your brain, stay active. You know, don't veg in front of the TV. That'll rot your brain for sure. But those specific games, maybe, just maybe, a bridge too far in terms of claims. 888-302-3684 is our number. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we'll take some calls in just a moment on Intelligent Medicine.
You're listening to Intelligent Medicine, brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. You can find a lot more on Intelligent Medicine at drhoffman.com. Subscribe to the Intelligent Medicine podcast and automatically get a new episode 5 days a week. And please rate and review the podcast on iTunes to help us spread the word about Intelligent Medicine. Also go to drhoffman.com and click on the store to buy your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. Finally, become a patient at the Hoffman Center. I'll personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles you hear about on the radio show and podcast, or make an appointment with Layla Mudin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Thanks for listening and for helping to spread the word about Intelligent Medicine.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. And Tim is calling us from Lebanon, New Hampshire. How are you doing, Tim?
Good. Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Your previous topic, there's a book out entitled Over-Diagnosis, and it's written by a Dr. Welch.
Yeah, H. Gilbert Welch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that covers the whole gamut of issues that you addressed.
I'm a big fan of Dr. Welch. In fact, we've had him as a guest on Intelligent Medicine. And, you know, his contention is that for a whole number of tests, we really have to examine the rationale for the tests. Because, well, yes, the tests can sometimes reveal disease, but at what cost? What material cost in terms of the testing? But hey, you know, let's be lavish and let's just expend enormous resources to find disease even in a few individuals. But the problem is the tests sometimes create undue anxiety, undo additional testing, and lead to unnecessary treatment. So, Tim, are you aware of the situation with Ben Stiller, who just went public with his prostate cancer diagnosis in an essay?
No, I'm not.
You heard of this? Okay, so let me share this with you, and you know, stay on the line because you bring up an important issue.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sure. You know, Ben Stiller has sort of become the poster boy for a test called the PSA test. That's the prostate-specific antigen test, and it's designed as a test to screen for prostate cancer. So he's come out and said that, quote, taking the PSA test saved my life, literally. That's why I am writing this now. He was 46 when he was diagnosed in 2014 with prostate cancer. And ordinarily, you know, men wait longer. So in his instance, the doctor urged him to take the PSA test before it's generally recommended. And he attributes his survival to the fact that the doctor was aggressive in screening and found that the PSA was a little elevated, then repeated it was even more elevated. And lo and behold, they did an MRI and they found that there was some cancer concealed in his prostate. And he says, there's been a lot of controversy over the test in the last few years. This is Ben Stiller. Articles and op-eds and whether it is safe, including, by the way, op-eds by this self-same H. Gilbert Welch, who argues against the test. Studies that seem to be interpreted many different ways and debates about whether men should take it at all. I'm not offering a scientific point of view here, just a personal one based on my experience. The bottom line for me, I was lucky enough to have a doctor who gave me what they call a baseline PSA test when I was about 46. I have no history of prostate cancer in my family, and I'm not in a high-risk group, being neither, to the best of my knowledge, of African or Scandinavian ancestry, and I had no symptoms. So, big controversy. And, you know, what's the controversy about with PSA? I mean, look, you got a test which can tell you have cancer. Doesn't get any better than that, right? So why not do the test? There was a big
actually was an opinion rendered by a major scientific group that said that men should not get routine PSAs anymore. And this created a lot of controversy because a lot of urologists rightly said that PSAs have saved men's lives. So, you know, what's the answer? The issue with prostate cancer is that, by the way, there's no assurance that getting an early diagnosis of prostate cancer will save Ben Stiller's life one way or the other, because a couple of problems occur. One is with prostate cancer can sometimes be a very slow-growing cancer that can actually be managed with watchful waiting, or better yet, with active holistic surveillance, where people take some very, very positive steps to change their diet, take certain supplements. I've written very extensively about this, and I've interviewed, you know, several doctors who agree with me on this, that taking a conservative approach to a diagnosis of prostate cancer, early stage prostate cancer, can be very workable. And in fact, there was recently a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that found that almost half of the men who decided to just take a watch and wait approach to prostate cancer, opting for active surveillance over aggressive radiation or surgery, didn't need any additional treatment over the course of 10 years. So many men diagnosed with prostate cancer, they have prostate cancer, they live with it, they die of something else, especially when men are older, which argues against screening in the over 70 age group. Then there's, you know, the other unfortunate fact, which is that whether or not you detect it early, and this sounds a little fatalistic, prostate cancer, we don't have the perfect treatment for it. And sometimes aggressive treatment makes little difference. I mean, it sounds fatalistic. We don't want to give up on men, but, you know, that's the fact of the matter right now. So what could go wrong with treating it aggressively? Well, treating prostate cancer aggressively has actually been shown in some cases not to extend men's lives. They die less of prostate cancer, but they die more of diabetes and heart disease and just plain, you know, heartbreak, because you're having urinary problems, having sexual problems is very debilitating for men. And it sometimes curtails their will to live, literally. And I've had men say, I'd rather die of prostate cancer than get the treatment. It's just so debilitating. So the biopsies, sometimes not safe. The biopsies can create problems, complications. They're certainly unpleasant. And then the worry and apprehension associated with us make it arguable that just maybe we don't need to do, you know, so many of these tests. And, you know, I have to face this on a daily basis in my practice, deciding where and when men need PSAs. I think, you know, one instance where men need PSAs is if you have a man on testosterone, say, and you want to monitor their response to testosterone, make sure that it's okay. Then these are men who need regular PSAs, just like women on hormone replacement therapy need mammograms. But, you know, this is it's a dilemma. And, you know, there really is no answer except that I think we need better tests for cancer that help us decide who's going to really benefit from therapy and who's not. Does that sound reasonable, Tim?
Sure. Yes, thanks. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for bringing that up. And I'll share this one with you, which is something that I'm personally getting more involved with. You know, as I get older, you know, I do a lot of running, biking, swimming, you know, working with weights. But I recognize that one limitation that I have is inflexibility. So I've begun to explore more the use of yoga. And yoga is something I wish I'd started earlier because, you know, it's the older you start, the harder it is to reverse the stiffness and immobility that occurs as you age. But this is an interesting sidelight to yoga. Yoga may be a viable option for people with generalized anxiety disorder. A recent study at Georgia State University shows that yoga may have a beneficial effect on worry. Yoga tended to reduce worry, which is a main facet of GAD, general anxiety disorder. And how that happens is that yoga is really working with the science of the breath. You get into uncomfortable positions sometimes, and you learn to stay with those positions. And that actually is a good way of teaching your body to deal with the uncomfortable sensations of anxiety. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. 888-302-3684 is our number. We'll be back with another hour of the weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.